Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, employee-owned and operated, and founded on the principle of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, that's right. It's Monday. Good afternoon, everybody. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking with the editor-in-chief of the Food and Environment Reporting Network. His name is Sam Frommartz. He's been a guest on this show a few times in the past, and I'm really happy to welcome him back. But before we get to Sam, I just have a couple of items in the joys and sorrows category that I wanted to share with you. The first one was that the environmental health news, EHN, which is one of my favorite trade blogs that I follow on the internet a lot. They have just published like a 4 or 5 part series called Peak Pig, all about the pig industry. And I highly recommend it. It's really, of course, if you haven't read my book, What's the Matter with Meat, then you'll really need to read this. It kind of covers some of the same material, but that's because it's the same material. I highly recommend the series, and it doesn't take too long to read it, but neither does my book, so you can also buy that. In fact, I would prefer it personally, but I understand not everybody wants to. And then the other thing I wanted to bring up today is that Sonny Perdue, our new agricultural secretary, has pulled out of the interim final GPSA rule, which was a really important piece of legislation that would have had a major impact on all livestock farmers, whether you're a niche farmer or especially for a commodity farmer. And what it would have done was allowed farmers and ranchers to protest unfair practices, price fixing, and various other perfidies that are visited upon them by the commodity livestock industry. And they would have been allowed to sue individually, whereas right now, if they want to sue a big packer, they have to prove that what the packer is doing is hurting the industry across the board, as opposed to just that particular farmer, which makes it basically impossible for farmers to sue about unfair contract practices and so forth. So this is our administration at work doing its best to undermine agriculture. And I think everybody is aware. I don't know if you people read, but should have read Michael Lewis's expose in, believe it or not, Vanity Fair about what's happening at the USDA, but it's pretty alarming, given that they're, half of the positions are unfilled, and the other half are filled by people who have no business being in the USDA. We luckily dodged the bullet of Sam Clovis, but believe me, the rest of the people that have been recruited to work in the agency don't really have a lot more use there than Sam did. So with that, we will take a quick sponsor drop here, and we'll come right back with Sam Frommartz from the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, and we'll talk about hunger in America under the Trump administration. Stay tuned.
Hey, I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife, Charlie, started Bob's Red Mill almost four decades ago. Today, they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his four children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
And thank you to Bob's Red Mill for supporting Heritage Radio Network. We love you, Bob. And now, this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. And I'm Katie Kiefer. And on the line with me today is Sam Frommartz, who is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Food and Environment Reporting Network. He's an author and veteran journalist who focuses on the intersection of the environment, food, and farming. He began his career at Reuters, and since leaving that news agency, his articles have appeared in Fortune, Business Week, The New York Times, and The Washington Post, among others. He is the author of Organic Inc., Natural Foods and How They Grew. And then his most recent book, which he was interviewed for here a couple of years ago now, is In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey, which seems like, you know... Just, you know, why not write a book about bread? And it is a lovely book. It won the IACP Award for Literary Food Writing in 2015 and was shortlisted for the Art of Eating Book Prize. Since serving as the founding editor of FERN, Food Environment Reporting Network, also known as FERN, the organization has won two James Beard Journalism Awards, and it also won a Journalism Award from IACP. Sam blogs at ChooseWise, which I love the pun there, Sam. I've always enjoyed that. And for some reason, are you still doing that blog?
It's kind of fallen off the cliff lately. Too busy with my day job.
Yeah, I figured. But I used to really enjoy it. It was it was kind of a catch-all for like basically the way I do joys and sorrows, where whatever interests me, I bring up. It seemed like ChooseWise was kind of that kind of vehicle for you as well.
Yeah, we might ramp it up again.
I hope so.
You know, and then everything shifts to Facebook and other platforms. So.
Yeah, that's true. So, Sam, you were the moderator of a panel which took place just recently. I think it was November 8th in California. And the idea of the panel was to explore action-oriented community solutions to mitigate the impact of the Trump administration's proposed SNAP cuts, as well as their watered-down school lunch standards and basically the anti-immigrant policies have an impact on hunger and food security. So you had some really great people, including one of my absolute all-time favorite guests, Ricardo Salvador, who I think is just so brilliant and so articulate that I just bow down in front of Ricardo. But you had some other great people too. Elizabeth Gomez, who works as the outreach program manager at the Alameda County Community Food Bank. Jessica Bartholomew, policy advocate at the Western Center on Law and Poverty. Alexis Guild, senior health policy analyst at Farm Worker Justice. So it was really an all-star group. So why don't you start by talking a little bit about what the goals of this panel were and what were the topics that really that you really covered in depth?
Yeah, well, the panel was titled "The Empty Plate: Fighting Hunger in the Age of Trump," and really, what we wanted to do was explore, you know, issues of food access that people are facing, you know, since the Trump administration. I mean, obviously, the economy is doing, you know, better than it was in the last recession, but you know, food access is still a big issue for a lot of Americans. The fiscal year that just ended, 42 million people were enrolled in SNAP benefits, which food stamps have become. And, you know, so there's still quite a number of people that depend on it. And largely those households are, you know, people with children, you know, seniors, or those with disabilities, folks really, you know, the more vulnerable population among us. But we were really asked what's happening with the administration, and that's what we hoped that people would answer, and they did.
You know, that 42 million people, food insecure people in this country, that number has been around for a while. Like, I feel like that number happened right after the crash in 2008. So there's been no real change in that?
No. It was actually higher during the recession, and has definitely come down. But it's still a large number. And you know, I think it sort of speaks to the point that a lot of the economic gains that are occurring in the country, even, you know, the low unemployment rate, I mean, it's passing a lot of people by. We keep reading about, you know, wages haven't really budged.
Right.
And I think this is a reflection of that. A couple years ago, we had done a photo essay on the faces of food stamps, looking at people actually receive it. And there's this kind of, a stereotype of food use. Food stamps, and it's, you know, it's really actually a wide swath of society, from people in the military, veterans, a lot of people who are big, but just can't, you know, afford to put food on the table. You know, a lot of students can't afford food, and so they're, you know, so it's not, you know, it's not sort of you know, if you have this image of a person's mind, it's actually quite a wide swath of society. And, you know, in this talk, I came across one figure that really astounded me, which was that half of all adults in this country will at some time receive some form of food assistance, which is, you know, which figure and shows how crucial it's are.
Absolutely. I mean, as one of your panelists pointed out at a certain point during the talk, it's like, you know, these people, if they don't get food stamps, it's not like they can go someplace else. It's like, if they don't get food stamps, they don't get food. And that's a basic thing. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about the discussion was actually two things. One was that the economic trade-off between SNAP and jobs, like one of your panelists said that every dollar of benefit that goes out into the community generates $1.79 in return in terms of economic activity overall. And I wondered if you could kind of parse that out for people, because I thought that was one of the most interesting statistics I heard.
I mean, it's interesting now in the context of like the tax cut that we're all reading about, you know, And it's talked, you know, the idea is that if you cut taxes on corporations, you know, they will give they will either invest more or hire more people or, you know, give more money to people in their pocket. And that's like a theory. But actually, one thing about food stamps and the reason that it works so well, especially in a recession, is that people immediately spend that money on food. And that is stimulative to the economy in a very direct way. We know people will get food, you know, SNAP benefits, will spend that money on food. You know, if you give a tax cut to a corporation, you don't actually know what's going to happen.
Yeah, right.
So, that figure came out of the USDA study, which said every dollar in SNAP benefits will reduce $1.75 in economic activity. And that's the effect of what's known as the multiplier effect. So it's not just buying the food with that money, but it's, you know, the people who work at the supermarket and the truckers who deliver the food and the, you know, companies that produce it. And it just goes, you know, the multiplier effect goes on and on. That's why it's, especially during a recession, why it's so stimulative to the economy. You put money in people's pockets and they'll immediately spend it. That'll help the economy as a whole. And, the USDA has even projections of how many jobs, you know, SNAP benefits creates that effect. So something like 9,000 to 18,000 jobs are created out of every increase in SNAP benefits.
If they, like in California, they're talking about a reduction of SNAP benefits. Obviously, that would be a federal, you know, federal event. But in California, a reduction in SNAP would have a disproportionate impact on farm workers. And I wondered if you could describe the sort of confluence of issues there in California that result in this ultimate irony that the folks who basically pick and process most of our fruits and vegetables don't actually have enough to eat themselves. Why does that happen? I mean, I know there's low wages, and that's right. Obviously the biggest issue. But there are other aspects that have an impact on whether or not people who work in agriculture get what they need in terms of survival.
Yeah, I mean, Alexis Gilt, who's a senior policy analyst with Farm Worker Justice, they're a farm worker organization, she gave the astounding figure that over 80% of farm workers are insecure, are food insecure. So that means, you know, that more than 8 out of 10 workers who are picking our food can't afford to buy the food, you know, themselves, which is astounding.
Well, it's just shocking.
You know, yeah, and this obviously focused in California because that's where the panel was, but, you know, you think of farm workers, you know, in really many states, not just California.
Right.
I would guess
that almost any ag state, and I'm sure this also applies to people who work in meat processing. I mean, that's my bailiwick. That's where I know the industry the best. But that, you know, that's definitely an issue in meat packing and processing. It's the same thing. You have a lot of brown people working, many of whom are undocumented. And that has an impact on whether or not they get paid the fair wage that they need to survive. We're back with Sam Frommaerts, Editor-in-Chief of Food and Environment Reporting Network. We're talking about hunger in the age of Trump and a recent panel discussion that Sam moderated. And just now we were talking about sort of why it is so that so many agricultural workers in California, but also really across all of the agricultural states in the United States, those workers are so typically underpaid that they end up being recipients of SNAP benefits. And so the ultimate irony is that the people who produce our food are the people who can't buy it. And we were talking a little bit about some of the many influences that go into making that happen. So, Sam, I'm going to let you pick it up from there and talk about some of the other issues.
And I don't want to just single out farm workers. And obviously, this is a food show, so that's important. But it's really people who are on the lower end of the economic spectrum.
Sure.
And, you know, and today, the majority of those people live in rural areas. And so they're really the ones who are dependent, you know, on these benefits.
Right.
And with undocumented workers, the issue is complicated because the agricultural industry obviously depends on these workers. Over half the workers who work in agriculture, you know, harvesters, et cetera, you know, are undocumented, but they actually don't qualify for SNAP benefits because you need to, you need to have some residency status to get that. So they're really dependent for food, you know, food emergencies on food banks and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, but just to back up, I mean, the whole issue that we're talking about, with the current administration is really, it sort of arose because the administration proposed a 25% cut in food stamp benefits, as well as scaling back the WIC program, which goes to women, infants, and children.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans in Congress are also pursuing similar measures of cutting benefits through a program of block grants, which would give states, you know, a set amount of money for these benefits.
Right.
The main criticism of that is that these programs really kick in during a recession. And if you have a set amount of money going to states, you know, if suddenly your population in your state seeking these benefits, you know, goes up by, you know, 10% or 20% or 50%, you know, you still have the same amount of money coming from that block grant, so you can't really meet the need.
Right.
So that's, you know, that's one of the main issues. And
that's quite terrifying, isn't it?
That's what's being played out in Congress right now.
Yes.
With the you know, budget discussions and
tax cuts, you had some interesting comments about sort of what the cost of hunger and food insecurity is to the overall economic picture, and this is why I'm always amazed by the stupidity of the people in Congress, particularly the Republicans. It's the same thing with the healthcare thing, Bill. Like, if you take away people's healthcare costs explode. If you take away people's food, then you have any number of ancillary impacts. And I wondered if you would talk a little bit about how, for example, having food stamps as a young person, how that correlates to a better outcome in later life, stuff like that. There was some very interesting discussion around that, and I wanted you to recapitulate a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it was a study that I mentioned, which looked at people who had received SNAP benefits which were then food stamps, in the 1960s when they were children, and what their outcomes were when they became adults, and it compared that group of people to other adults who had not received any benefits, you know, when they were kids in the 1960s and who were also food insecure. And this was a study published last year, and it showed that, you know, decades later, that the adults who received food stamps as children were more likely to be in good health. They had higher education levels, higher unemployment and earnings, and lower poverty rates. So, the fact that they tackled food security when they were kids, you know, had all these better outcomes when they were adults. And you see that also with things like the school lunch program, that kids, you know, who have a breakfast, you know, can focus, better on school during the day, that kind of thing. So, for many kids, the most stable meal that they receive is, you know, school lunch.
Yeah.
So, and that, you know, so it's a really important program.
Why is it that legislators don't make that correlation? Who is not bringing this to their attention? I don't understand. Help me, Sam.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it all comes down to the issue of, the old saw of, you know, it should be personal responsibility. It should be on yourself. And I think one good point that Ricardo Salvador made was, you know, he pointed to the structural issues that that people face, and it's not just a question of personal responsibility. It's a question of what lines of economic access do you have open to you? What jobs are available? How much do they pay? You know, that kind of thing. And he made the good point that actually, if people were paid a decent wage at the lower end of the ladder, you know, there would be less need for these programs, which is true, which is why his organization, for example, is advocating for the $15, you know, minimum wage.
Right.
That's one sort of structural issue. Another huge structural issue is the fact that food companies are actually big advocates of SNAP benefits because it sells a lot of food. You know, if 41 million Americans are on these programs, you know, they're buying food. So if you take that away, you know, that in the same way that food stamps can have a multiplier effect in creating economic activity. If you take it away, it could also reduce economic activity. So the third thing I would mention is that, you know, as I said, companies, you know, really, really depend on these programs for, for an economic benefit. So, maybe there was another point in there.
I'm sorry. I apologize for that, but that's okay because I have so many questions. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I hear a slight echo on my end too. I don't know if that's...
Do you? I'm not hearing that. But you sound fine now. So, and you talked a minute for about the block grants, but there was another issue that has been floated about able-bodied. You know, adults, meaning not elderly, not disabled, not children, being limited to 3 months of food stamp benefit or SNAP benefit out of every 36 months.
Right.
That to me was also like when I think about veterans, for example, that just seems so beyond the pale. I mean, you know,
that's what it is now, and that's what they want to reduce further.
Oh, really? So, it's already limited to 3 months.
Yes.
Wow. Yes. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
and then so they want to reduce that to what?
It's able-bodied adults without dependents. So if you're like a single person, you know, in their 30s and you hit a rough patch, you know, that you're only eligible for those benefits during that time.
Wow. And then there was
That's what they want to cut back on and,
And replace it with 1,000 points of light?
Yeah. More... You know, more restrictions in terms of how long you can get those benefits, and it might be limited to you actually have to be working, you know, that kind of thing.
My God!
It's just it gets back to this issue of, you know, the Republicans laws, you know, beat on, which is the personal responsibility issue.
Yeah, they do. I wanted to also bring up the public charge aspect of this, that also being a qualifier for not so much for acquiring food stamp benefit or SNAP benefits, but for acquiring citizenship or a path towards citizenship. Because in a lot of ways, these issues are so tied up into immigration and immigration reform. And I know we don't want to so much get into the immigration side of it, but there's that whole aspect of being a public charge that could have an impact on your path to citizenship. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah,
I've never heard that before, by the way.
Walk you through that because it's a complicated issue, but it stems from one thing that we were surprised to hear from the panelists, which is Like, for example, Alameda County Food Bank started to get calls from people asking that they be taken off food stamps. And the reason was, and to not receive benefits. And the reason that these people were asking for that is they thought it would impact their immigration status down the line. And so these were people who might have, you know, permanent residency, you know, green card or whatever. And there was a rumor going around that if you were going to receive food stamps, that it would somehow make you give you a designation of public charge, which under federal law would prevent you from eventually getting citizenship. So that was, that has not happened. There's a rumor, you know, given the whole sort of anti-immigrant climate, there's a fear that it might happen.
Yeah.
And so that's why people were trying to get themselves off the, you know, off these benefits. And, you know, which is, I think, alarming in the sense that, you know, if you were dependent on these benefits to feed your family, so what are you then going to do?
Right.
You know, how are you going to put food on the table? So that's a real concern. What is clear though is that when you get food from a food bank, which is, you know, you go and just get a bag of groceries or whatever, whatever they give, you know, then there are no questions about, you know, your status or anything else.
That's right.
So people can still get access to emergency food aid. But we were also hearing that people were not going to, you know, medical clinics anymore for the same reason. They didn't want their names entered in any system that would somehow be trackable by the federal government. So, you know, so this is all the sort of the climate of fear.
Yeah,
you know, that that undocumented workers or even those who are documented are operating under.
Sure, it's terrifying. Let's turn for a minute to some solutions. Like, what were some of the conclusions of the panel in terms of after these problems are laid out? And Ricardo, I really urge people to listen to this. It's on the FERN Facebook page. The isn't that right, Sam? It's on the FERN.
Yeah.
You can listen to the whole panel. It's like an hour long.
The video is archived.
Yeah, it's got a lot of really interesting information. And then Ricardo Salvador just breaks it all down into something that is not something that's just happening now, but it is something that is institutionalized and systematized into what you want to call food policy, I guess, in this country, and has to do with wages and all of the rest. But I guess what I was looking for from the panel, and I can't say that I really got a strong sense of what solutions outside of legislation. I mean, Ricardo talked about using current laws and regulations to move the needle forward on, you know, improving the lot of the poor in general. But I didn't really know what those laws and regulations were and also how they would have applied to some of the issues that say that big food bank in Alameda County is facing, where they have like 100,000 people a month are looking for food there. I mean, that's a huge amount of food to round up every month.
Yeah, you know?
So,
yeah.
Like, what were the ideas that you guys came up with?
In a simple way, it was being aware of the issues, obviously, you know, supporting those organizations that are doing this work. But I think more importantly, a lot of these organizations, and it could be, you know, your local food bank in whatever city you're in, you know, has advocacy campaigns, that kind of thing, to advocate for these issues. And, you know, there's been like a historic, I would call it compromise or deal between the farm states and urban states. And essentially the urban lawmakers will vote for, the subsidies that farm states are looking for their farmers, And in return, the farm state legislators typically vote in favor of continued SNAP benefits and that kind of thing. And, you know, for the people in the audience who don't know, the things like farm subsidies as well as SNAP benefits, they are part of the farm bill, which comes around every 5 years, and we're up for a new farm bill next year. So all right. of these issues are currently in play, and given the fractured state of our politics these days, it's uncertain, you know, how things are going to play out. So I think that's why now particularly it's important to get involved in these issues.
Oh, most definitely. I wanted to go back to something about earlier when you were talking about the demographic of people who receive SNAP benefits in this country. And, you know, you made it clear that it encompasses a wide swath of the population. But I always thought that actually the biggest recipient group of SNAP benefits were white people. And generally speaking, they seem to be the ones who voted for Trump. And I'm just curious, like, has there been any response from that kind of community, those rural white communities in the heartland and so on, in response to the idea that their SNAP benefits might be cut?
Well, I mean, it was not just SNAP benefits. It was also health care.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, right.
So, I don't think there has been... I mean, the articles that I've read about Trump's base is they're still with him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not sure what it will take to change that, if anything. But I think, you know, as we've seen in healthcare and as we're going to, you know, potentially see with these food access benefits, I mean, it will have a big impact across a wide, you know, swath of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, food insecurity is slightly higher in rural areas than in cities, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a racial breakdown, but you know, you're probably right. But it's basically anyone in the lower end of the income spectrum who is dependent on these benefits and potentially, you know, will be hurt by any cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you think of the most vulnerable populations, you're talking about kids, you're talking about the elderly, and you're talking about the disabled.
Yeah.
So it's troubling.
It's very troubling. And, you know, I start thinking about things like, well, you were saying earlier, like, well, what do they do if their SNAP benefits get cut and they can't put food on the table for their family? I'm thinking, well, I would rob somebody, you know, I would steal. I mean, you know, people are driven to do quite desperate things when it comes to seeing a child or an elderly parent or your wife or whatever, you know, suffering from hunger pangs. And, you know, I'm seeing that we could see some civil unrest in the future if we start really being draconian about these SNAP cuts. And I just wonder how far in the future, you know, American politicians are able to think about those things. It doesn't seem like that many of them.
Hopefully it won't get to
I
that
hope
point,
not.
And hopefully there'll be enough pushback, you know, that these kind of cuts that they're talking about won't go through.
I think it's
a question mark.
Yeah. I mean, who would you consider an ally in this battle? In Congress, like who are your favorite senators who support SNAP benefits and the expansion of Medicaid and the health care bill, the kind of people who really who will go to the mat for this, not on the Democratic side, but who in the Republican Party do you think is likely to push back against these crazy budget cuts, for example?
Well, I think actually there's been a lot of positive statements from, as you know, as I said, from farm state legislators, mm-hmm. who recognize that, you know, they might not get what they need if a program like SNAP benefits is cut dramatically. But a lot of things are in play because you have a whole, you know, Republican caucus now, a part of it that, you know, does want to cut back on these programs and also wants to cut back farm supports.
Right.
So I think that's where this sort of historic coalition of farm state legislators and urban lawmakers, you know, I think the question is, you know, can they hold enough weight to sort of counter these new trends?
That's the Tea Party side of things, is what you're talking about,
yeah,
right? Those guys,
yeah,
and like the Rand Pauls,
conservatives,
Well, the fiscal conservatives seem to be ready to put us into a gigantic debt hole again through the tax cuts. So I'm not even sure who they are. You know what I mean? It's like they've forgotten about fiscal conservatism. And as one pundit said, the only reason they're not talking about it now is because then after they enact the tax cuts and they get what they want, then they can say, oh, my God, we're going to have a terrible deficit. We have to cut all these entitlement programs now. I mean, that does seem to be the playbook, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, you know, constituents, I think, in farm country is, you know, and I'm not talking about, like, the small farmers. I'm talking about, like, the big farmers who tend to support the big commodity groups. I mean, they're already worried about things like, you know, the drumbeat against NAFTA and things like that where, you know, that have clearly benefited them. I mean, Mexico and Canada are the number two and number three biggest markets for farm exports.
Sure.
So, you know, they're already worried. And then when you start fraying at their, you know, subsidy net, that further causes concern. So, you know, it's, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that a lot of things are in play, and it's not clear how this is all going to shake out. And it's not, you know, it's not a clear, like, Democratic versus Republican, you know, sort of fissure on these issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You've given me a lot to think about, just in terms of the way they cut a deal between the farm states and the urban areas. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to give you this if you give me that.
What it, you know, yeah. The deal.
I hadn't really thought about it that way.
That's what happens every 5 years. And the question is that deal going to hold, you know, this time around?
Right. Well, we're going to wrap it up there, Sam. Thank you so much for joining me today. And now is your opportunity to promote yourself and your publication shamelessly.
Well, if you want to see our work, you know, visit thefern.org, and you'll see a lot of our in-depth investigative journalism. You'll also see a link there for our Ag Insider daily policy briefing. That's where a lot of the, if you want to follow, you know, the ins and outs of what's happening with things like the Farm Bill, that's the Ag Insider is the place to look.
Fantastic.
But
I love Chuck Abbott.
Seeking, like, a more, you know, in-depth kind of storytelling, great photographs, that kind of thing, then our long form pieces on thefern.org is the place to go.
Well, thank you so much. And I urge people to check out the Fern website because it is terrific. And if you don't subscribe to the Ag Insider with Chuck Abbott, who's also been a guest on this program, you should do so now because it's an invaluable tool for watching sort of the ins and outs, the stuff that you don't see reported really in any other format. In any other certainly not in the mainstream media. So my hat's off to you guys for doing such a great job. I love Fern, and I always have. And I think I was one of your earliest supporters. Didn't I have you on to talk about Fern when
you
first started
it? Yeah, you've been there since the start.
I have indeed.
Really appreciate your support.
Absolutely.
And we love being on your show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure it will be happening more and more as more and more things unfold. Anyway, thanks to you, Sam, and thanks to my sponsor, Bob's Red Mill. And I'm going to take a minute here to just remind people this is our end of the year fund drive. We have until December 31st to raise $150,000. That money goes towards keeping my show and all the other great shows on the air, as well as our special projects like the Modernist Breadcrumbs series that is being put together by my one and only engineer, Dave Tacitore. And I know I said that wrong, Dave. Never mind. but do you know, go to the website, hit the donate button, become a member of Heritage Radio Network, or if you're in a business and you want to subscribe to our, you know, become a sponsor, that would be absolutely awesome. We do a lot of sponsor drops for our people. We help them out in as many ways as we can, and it doesn't cost a whole lot of money to become a sponsor. So whether you want to become a member individually or become a sponsor or business partner or whatever it is, join us so that we can continue the work that we do here. Some of it is fun, like Wedding Cake, or, you know, Dave Arnold's amazing show, which I can never remember the name of, but anyway, I love it. And all the other people, Linda Palacio with Taste of the Past, another great show. There's 36, 37 of us now, maybe 40. We might even be up to 40 shows. I think we put four more on this year. So join us. Become a member. Support Food Radio. We're the only game in town that does this to the extent and the depth that we do. Thanks for listening now, and we'll see you next week. So long, folks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.